Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Who shot JR? One of many questions that we'll be asking ourselves over the next few weeks. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Don, you ready to travel to a beautiful place called 1980?
Surely you can't be serious.
I'm serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Call me late for dinner.
Wow, that one too. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums in the album format. We also love the 80s.
We sure do.
And that's going to take us on a journey over the next few episodes. We have a great show for you. We'll be discussing two handpicked albums from 1980 with some parameters. Don's going to ask us a deep question. And then we'll have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items that we're digging. And then, of course, we will spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what kind of albums we'll be talking about in 1981. But today, it's all about the year
1980. That's what I'm talking about!
Our I Love the 80s tour kicks off right where the decade begins. 1980 sits at a crossroad between the shaggy experimentation of the 1970s and the sleek, high-gloss culture that would define the 1980s. It's a year where punk's raw energy splinters into new wave metal and post-punk, while blockbuster movies and cable TV begin reshaping how people experience stories and music. Right, one of us will present an R&B record from this year, and the other will counter with a rock gem, each album catching a different side of the moment when analog grit started colliding with sleek studio polish. Together, they sketch out how 1980 sounded in guitars, grooves, and the first hints of the decade to come.
So there was a lot of considerations. Some things we've talked about before on the show recently, or artists that we talked about recently, so we avoided them. Like Black Sabbath, Heaven and Hell was one of the first things to come to mind. That's when Ronnie James Dio joined the band. And it was a very different sounding band by this point than the late 60s, early 70s. But we just talked about Black Sabbath, so I had to look elsewhere.
We definitely have to do it soon.
Yeah.
I thought about doing Diana Ross's album, Diana, which was produced by the members of Chic, Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards. But I feel like I've been going to that well quite a bit. So, you know, maybe we'll let that stuff breathe.
If I had had the R&B pick, that would have been the one.
Yeah, it is a Chic record, basically, with Diana's voice, I think, and her, you know, charisma.
And of course, AC/DC's Back in Black, which we did talk about, I think, on an episode where we focused on 1980, or it could have been where we focused on bands with new lead singers.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a great record and a hallmark of 1980 as well.
Yeah, and I think in the 1980 episode, we did the Talking Heads' Remain in Light, which is an excellent album.
And Bruce Springsteen, The River. Mm. That's a long one, though. But we should do that or Nebraska one of these days, get into the weeds a little bit on Springsteen. But yeah, there was a lot to consider.
Yeah, there's a Stevie Wonder album in there, Hotter Than July. Some good funk, The Gap Band, Cameo. They were already going by 1980.
So. Yeah, but they're nothing till they Word Up came out a little later in the 80s. There was a whole lot to choose from, but, you know, I'm glad we had the narrowed down to two genres, although I kind of cheated, I think. All right, the picks are in. 1980, she's a-waiting. Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
My R&B pick from 1980 comes from George
Jetson, that'd be sweet.
Jet Screamer.
Yeah, I think so.
Hey, so my R&B pick from 1980 comes from George Benson and an album called Give Me the Night, released in August of that year. George Benson is an American jazz guitarist and vocalist who, you know, kind of bridged straight-ahead jazz, soul jazz, and smooth R&B. He rose up as like a sideman and musician sort of in the bop roots. So, you know, he was a full-on, you know, jazz guy.
Yeah.
But here, you know, he's kind of entering more of the world of pop, R&B, and funk, and it's produced by Quincy Jones.
Yeah, they're sort of taking that journey together, because Quincy is a jazz guy too, right?
That's true. Let's start it out. Here's the opening cut, Love Times Love. Love, 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 love,
So I think like you plus me equals us. Love times love equals love.
Yes. Yeah, when you look at it, it just kind of looks like love x love, but that's supposed to be the multiplication symbol. So Love Times Love is written by Rod Temperton, who was in the band Heatwave. He seems to collaborate a lot on these Quincy Jones albums. Mm-hmm. Does he have songwriting credits on some Michael Jackson?
Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, he also wrote Rock With You mm-hmm. and Off the Wall and Burn This Disco Out on the Off the Wall album for Michael mm-hmm. Jackson. And I mean, he wrote for a lot of different artists, Herbie Hancock, James Ingram, etc. But also he wrote Thriller, Baby Be Mine, The Lady in My Life on the Thriller album. So, yeah.
Yeah, not too shabby.
Not at all.
So he co-wrote it with Benson. Also some songwriting credit to Allie Willis. Kind of a ballad-leaning track, sort of between that soul and easy listening sophistication. Mm-hmm. But there's still the jazz vibe in there, some electric piano, some strings. Benson's it's kind of fun to listen for his guitar on these tracks. Because it's often kind of subtle it's kind of quiet in the mix, but you can pick it out and it's often pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of the foundation of a lot of it. And his vocalizations, he does a lot of scatting and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm familiar with an album that came after this one that my parents had when I was little. But he does a lot of do-do-do-do-do stuff. But he does it with the guitar. So if you're listening closely, it's like a guitar mini, but it's his voice and his guitar. He's such a guitar player that his improvisation goes with his fingers. Mm-hmm.
Dave Gilmore does that on Wish You Were Here.
Oh, boy. Good God, man. Did you have that ready or did this just come to this Pink Floyd stuff?
No, I didn't. It just occurred to me.
My God.
It's not fair to have somebody like, I feel like you should either be a great guitarist or a great vocalist. But I think Benson is both, I don't know. It doesn't seem fair to be so good at two things.
Yeah. But I mean, I think vocally his guitar playing supports his vocals. Like we just kind of talked about sort of in the same way that Stevie Wonder is a great vocalist in Stevie's world and how it works with the piano. I wouldn't say he's like Luther Vandross or something in terms of like beautiful R&B voice.
That's true.
But it's a really nice voice, and his guitar work and his singing, they support each other so well that it just sounds awesome.
That's a good point. Like Billy Preston too, I think. Yeah, they have a voice that's like perfect for their
exactly
to go along with their instruments. Nice. All right, well let's hear, this was kind of the big cut from this album, also the title track, Give Me the Night.
Now to me that could have easily been a song on a Michael Jackson record.
Oh, sure.
Either Off the Wall or even Thriller. And kind of like that Baby Be Mine kind of vibe, and some of the lines just I can hear Michael Jackson's voice doing. And instead of the guitar scatting thing, it would have been the hee-hees and stuff.
Yeah.
Because he was an improviser too, vocally, but it stood alone from the instruments.
Yeah, the vocal phrasing and rhythm. I like the gimme tonight, So this one was written by Rod Temperton again and Quincy Jones. God, this is stuff I just would have rolled my eyes at or hated, when I was young. But now I eat it up. I don't know.
I would have liked it when I was like very young, because my dad worked in radio, so we listened to his local pop rock station, and I grew up on the radio, so I was all about the hits and stuff. So stuff like this I would have enjoyed as a little child, but this would have, by the time I was a teenager, this was I Rule City.
Yeah. And the lyrics similar to what you get in the disco era and funk, kind of a hedonistic invitation to enjoy the night and, forget your troubles. Nothing deep or, it's kind of just pure escapism.
I mean, by this point, George was probably about 37 or so. So I kind of think of it as maybe like a husband and wife are out for the night and the kid is with a babysitter, Because this is like grown-up disco. I think that's what I'm discovering now about the early 80s R&B soul sound, is it took a lot of those disco rhythms and then matured them a little bit. There's that vibe of escapism, but it's more like, but tomorrow you're going to wake up and do all the right things because you're an adult.
It's interesting having, you know, two jazz guys doing straightforward pop. You know, I mean, in the jazz world, it's almost like there's no rules. The rhythms change, the scales change. But in pop, it's like you got to, you know, work within the limits of 4-4 time and a scale. And I think that limitation maybe actually sort of inspires some additional creativity, you know, to be able to, to work within the limitations. All right, well, was there a track you wanted to focus on?
I mean, you kind of set me up pretty well here. I don't know if it was intentional. If so, hats off. But we're going to listen to a little bit of an instrumental track called Off Broadway, where some of that improvisation comes into play. Sing to me, George. Yeah, he doesn't even do any of the scatting on this one. It's quite shocking.
Yeah, I mean, that guitar line, I mean, it almost is like vocals, you know?
Yes. I mean, that's how he sings through his hands.
Yes. And I love that bass, too. That wow, 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 wow. Oof. Yeah.
So it is polished and melodic, and there's some synths and horns, and I think the meaning is kind of conveyed through the mood of another urban nightlife thing, sort of like the title track, but it is an intersection of jazz, funk, R&B, bridging the genres, kind of, and Quincy's production, where it really does feel like pop jazz or jazz fusion or something.
Yeah, I think the album, you know, was in danger of being just sort of easy listening. And, you know, these little jazz numbers in here, you know, just add something else to it, a little excitement.
Yeah, some support beams to hold up the structure. Won a Best R&B Instrumental Performance at the 1981 Grammys. I didn't know that was a category, but that's cool.
Yeah, I think that Billy Preston album we talked about might have won in that category, that too, that Space Race or whatever it was called.
But really, like, for this track, the fun of it is focusing on the guitar interplay, you know, writing along with that is the fun of the song.
Yeah. Okay, so we arrive at the final cut. Here's Turn Out the Lamplight.
So turn out the lamplight. Sit by my side. Love me tonight.
Whew. Yeah, nice cozy way to end the album. And I like the idea of, you know, turning the light out on the album, but, you know, it's also a sort of a romantic ballad. Another one that's written by Temperton and Quincy Jones. Yeah, his voice sounds really nice here. I could picture a Luther Vandross or, you know, one of those guys singing this as well.
What I thought about was the early Quiet Storm stuff. This is very much in that that category of those kind of grown-up R&B soul songs that's made for bubble baths and back rubs.
I could hear Smokey Robinson singing this. Mm-hmm. Could be on that album.
Yeah, I mean, it emphasizes love, but also kind of calm emotional depth, like a private moment between lovers. Mm-hmm. Kind of like romantic in like a deep love kind of way, but then it's also romantic in the bow chicka bow bow kind of way.
Yes, indeed.
And as you mentioned at the top of the discussion here, as the closer, it does really provide a nice reflective contrast to like the nightlife and all that stuff going on. But it showcases Benson's range. It's jazz influenced again. You can feel it, but it leans more into the soul side of things and it works well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's rewind and reflect on George Benson's Give Me the Night. I'll begin with my clickbait headline. Jazz hands meet slow hands on Benson's Give Me the Night.
Yeah, I guess using the mix of jazz hands and slow hands in a romantic encounter is probably the better way to go.
Okay.
Don't want to be too samey. Mix it up.
You know, it is definitely like a fusion album, right? You've got these elements of jazz instrumentation, but it's very smooth. You know, it's soulful and it's got these R&B grooves. Kind of grown up party vibes, right? But also the romance, you know. So it's got a little bit of everything.
My clickbait headline to describe the album: from studio precision to dance floor grooves, this is how 80s pop R&B learned to shine.
Indeed.
I think it's building blocks for that sound and kind of informed Quiet Storm, R&B, all that kind of stuff, the way that it shaped up throughout the 80s, even into the New Jack Swing era, as it sort of, the new sounds of hip hop then took this stuff and turned it into something else. But the other clickbait headline that just popped in my head was me and Quincy, Quincy Jones.
Yes.
Because Benson and Quincy crafted this distilled urban sophistication, and it's confident and smooth and layered and never flashy, but still engaging.
Absolutely. All right. Killer to Filler. I think there's, you know, a lot of strong tracks. I mean, you have kind of like a jazz standard or vocal standard that he does with Patty Austin, called Moody's Mood, you know, which is kind of fun. I think the interplay between the two vocalists is good.
Yeah, I think it kind of shows his bebop roots, but it is more accessible than your straight jazz, which I think is kind of the point here.
Yeah. Are you more a bebop guy or a rock steady guy? Or a Krang?
Okay. So we're talking about the Turtles?
Yes, I'm sorry.
I wasn't really into that. what about Star of a Story? What'd you think of that one?
I like it. You know, maybe a bit more kind of a sadder vibe.
Yeah, a late night aesthetic.
Yep. Yeah, you got the strings in there that, you know, make it sort of emotional.
I think it's a centerpiece for the album's mood. It worked well, I thought. Midnight Love Affair also.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't hate any tracks.
It's funny how they managed to tiptoe the line where it like almost gets there where it's cringy, but it doesn't. It doesn't get there. It's smooth and romantic with, and you know, kind of old fashioned sounding now, but without being like it's genuine. And real and musicianship and legit. It's not pandery.
Yeah. And then, I mean, like some of the R&B, as you get into the 90s and late 90s and 2000s, it definitely gets cringy, you know, and it's just more overt.
Yes. The nuance is not totally, but largely gone, where it's spelling out the details instead of hinting at things, which is, I think, kind of the fun, you know, of listening to something where it's like, ooh, what do they mean there? Yeah. Instead of like knocking the boots. It's like, well, that's pretty clear.
Gonna get freaky with you.
Yeah.
Production. I mean, you know, Quincy Jones, I feel like this is sort of in that beginning of his reign the R&B pop world.
Mm-hmm. But I think this helped build toward what they accomplished on Thriller with Michael Jackson as well.
Yep. And I mean, at times I thought I was listening to like a Lionel Richie record, you know, and I'm not sure exactly what the Quincy Jones sound is. I mean, there's often, you know, interesting instrumentation going on, but it doesn't have that like live in the room energy or something, you know, like it's very polished.
Yeah. I mean, I think what it, there's the groove drives the album without overshadowing the melody. And then the melody itself is supported by the guitars and the keys. And it's got that 70s polish, but with more space and restraint over the ornamentation. And I think that's what Quincy Jones brought to the mix. Like the music is so sharp.
Yeah.
And the vocalists that he worked with play against those instruments so well. And it also did not lose what makes George Benson George, the guitar and scat jazz guy, and somehow also frames him in a new way musically.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Replay value?
Yeah. It works for background ambiance.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like it really depends on, for me, yes. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be on the top of my list probably, but I'd go back to it. Kind of, and hopefully maybe in listening to this conversation we had, some people who may not have checked it out will.
Yeah. I really feel like tracks like Off Broadway really make the record just more, I don't know, more fun or more interesting. You know, it's not just romantic ballads. All right. Well, Legacy. It transformed, you know, Benson from like a jazz guy into a R&B pop star. But I think this with, you know, Quincy Jones and Rod Temperton, you know, I think it really, the blueprint was already starting, but it, you know, they're really getting to the point where they're establishing what 80s R&B was going to be.
Yeah. I also demonstrated that jazz roots could coexist with pop accessibility. Those horn stabs that are used so often in 80s pop, not just the R&B, but in pop music, so many saxophones and like these small jazz flourishes that made their way into all sorts of pop music, I think started, you know, people like Quincy Jones coming from a jazz background helped, you know, and the Commodores and bands like that as well, the funk bands, they helped bring that stuff into pop music. And that's the legacy of this as well.
Yeah. All right. Even outside the context of 1980, Give Me the Night still plays like a masterclass in tight grooves, warm guitar tone, and smooth, low-glare studio shine. Give it a spin.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. All right, well, we're going to be exploring the, you know, the musical significance of the 1980s. What are some significant musical moments from 1980?
I mean, what comes to mind for me, and I was very small at the time that this happened. So on December 8, 1980, former Beatle John Lennon was shot and killed in New York City outside his home at the Dakota. It was a high-rise building.
Yeah.
By Mark David Chapman, ending the life of one of rock's most influential figures. He was only, John Lennon was only 40 years old at the time, and it was shocking, you know.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Music history lost a defining voice. I think we lost Elvis a few years before, late 70s. And I think that was probably sobering to the baby boomers of the time who were like in their 30s and pushing, you know, maybe 40. And that's when you start to think this life isn't going to last forever. And then to have a musical hero like that just suddenly be gone. And it changed music for sure, his departure. So I just remember my parents being very shook up. I don't remember the details of it or having any feelings myself about it because I was a kid and I didn't really even know what death was. So.
Yeah, I was just a little too young to have any recollection of that. This one isn't quite as important culturally, I guess, but you know, we also lost another singer-songwriter, Ian Curtis of Joy Division. You know, tragically hanged himself, and the remaining members of the band then went on to, you know, to form New Order. And so those are two acts that are, you know, particularly significant to, you know, my musical palette.
Yeah, in that it's maybe not as well known yet, and Joy Division hadn't established themselves as like the Beatles, but I think it was very significant in terms of the way that new wave and synth pop and that whole side of pop music throughout the 80s was shaped by what happened with Ian Curtis.
Yeah. There's always, you know, the what ifs, you know, they were right on the verge of their first American tour, you know, and so who, you know, maybe, you know, they would have been huge. And then I was just thinking of another kind of technological development in the music world, which is the Walkman.
Changed everything.
Yeah. So that was, you know, the true Walkman, the brand name, you know, it comes from Sony. I don't think I ever actually had a Sony one. I'm sure I had like a Panasonic or some Sanyo or, you know, some knockoff, but. You know, I mean, it music really became portable at that point.
I had a Sony Discman at one point, but the Walkman, I think, you know, as far as our childhood goes, that was the iPhone of our childhood. You know, it was
the way to isolate you from the rest of the world.
Put on your headphones and listen to what you wanted to listen to, not have to rely on radio stations. And it was a way for teenagers to separate themselves from family members during all kinds of events. Yes. It started there, now social media is the evil one.
All right. Well, what are some other significant musical moments from 1980? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
I sort of cheated. I had rock, and rock is kind of an overarching term for a lot of things, and that included in 1980 heavy metal, which was still sort of establishing itself as a true genre. So since I couldn't go with Heaven and Hell, by Black Sabbath, I went with Iron Maiden and their debut album. Iron Maiden's an English heavy metal band from East London, formed by bassist and main songwriter Steve Harris, emerging from the mid-70s UK club and pub circuit, considered leaders of the new wave of British heavy metal, or Nwabum, as the nerds call it. The original lineup featured Paul Di'Anno on vocals. Bruce Dickinson shows up by the third album, and he has a more operatic delivery. Paul Di'Anno's a little more punk rock, I would say.
Yeah.
But this was faster, rougher, and more aggressive than traditional 70s hard rock, like taking another step or two forward from your Deep Purples and Alice Coopers and that kind
Judas
of thing.
Judas Priest. Yeah.
Well, Judas Priest was kind of on the same trajectory, I think, as Iron Maiden. So the self-titled debut album captures a raw, energetic version of the band before its later more polished epic metal direction. Like, as I mentioned, Paul has these kind of gritty punk-leaning vocals, and alongside Steve Harris and Dave Murray's foundational Maiden songwriting and guitar styles. So why don't we listen to a little bit of the opening track, Prowler. So a seminal piece of that new wave of British heavy metal. I guess the song was re-recorded from the band's 1978 Soundhouse tapes demo that that's how they got a record deal. But the song serves as a raw, energetic, aggressive blueprint for the genre, and the lyrics, walking through the city, of course, then rhyme that with pretty, you know, you got to do what you got to do, I guess, but suggest a singular focused mission, navigating the dark streets in search of thrills, connections, and carnal release. Kind of, it's called Prowler, so is this like a stalker thing, kind of a vibe where maybe he's a flasher, but the character is, it's an evil person. You know, and I think that's what they start touching on here is creeps that exist out in the world.
I found myself paying attention to Harris's bass lines. And, you know, I think that it makes a lot of the tracks, particularly this one, you've got like this propulsive, like heartbeat to the song that just kind of drives it. You know, it's kind of a relentless energy in his playing.
It's that galloping sound. I think the bass line, and then just Iron Maiden in particular, but a lot of these heavy metal bands from this era where it's, it sounds like galloping, like the way that it moves and speeds up and slows down.
And these guys were like Judas Priest, where they had like two guitarists, right? So it was, I think it's Dave Murray. And then I think the other guitarist for this album was Dennis Stratton. I don't think he hung around after this album.
There was a lot of turnover for in the early days in particular. But I think what sticks out to me most and how this is different from the other rock of the time and how metal became metal. So a lot of the early stuff, your Led Zeppelins and things were blues based, and this takes that and then adds the punk DIY attitude and ethos. Punk mattered to metal.
It's true.
All right, why don't we get into another track? This one is one of those I find quite interesting on the album. It's called Phantom of the Opera.
Dun, 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 dun.
What's that?
Andrew Lloyd Webber.
All right, so despite sharing its name with Gaston Leroux, his famous novel, that's French sounding, right? And later musical adaptations, as you referred to with Mr. Lloyd Webber, Iron Maiden's Phantom of the Opera is not a retelling of the Phantom story. Steve Harris stated in interviews that the title was chosen more for its dramatic imagery than like a literal narrative connection. Here, the Phantom more functions as a metaphor for this dangerous presence lurking in the shadows, and the lyrics are written from the perspective of someone who feels watched, stalked, or pursued. A lot of that in this record. I think that's the evils of life on the streets, you know.
I like some of these early metal records when they get kind of progressive, but they don't have the progressive like musical elements.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, so it's still just guitar rock.
Well, it's a long song for the era as well.
Yeah. See, I like that when they, you know, start, you know, taking it to interesting places, but they're not, you know, throwing in orchestration and, you know, crap like that. You know, it's just, you know, it's still pretty straightforward, just more imaginative.
Oh, they get more theatrical as time goes on. Iron Maiden in particular, but metal in general got more theatrical. But this, like I said, leans more to that street level fear and paranoia, like real fear and paranoia, not devils and stuff that kind of come later.
Right.
But it features multiple tempo changes, fast, aggressive passages, slower, ominous sections, and the shifts kind of mirror the emotional arc of the album, I think. Panic, tension, confrontation. And those dual guitars, Dave and Dennis, it's not like that had never been done before in rock music, but the speed, what maybe influenced speed metal and thrash later on,
sure,
all is here. All these ingredients are together, I think, for one of the first times. It's not fully cooked, but it tastes pretty good.
Deano kind of sounds sort of Ozzy-ish on this track. I guess the rhythm of his voice or something, or his delivery sounds kind of Ozzy in those faster parts.
On some of the songs, when he tries to go high, the moments where it should go high, he sounds like Geddy Lee to me.
Mm. Yeah, he doesn't have the ability to do what
Bruce Dickinson could do. You know, when they got more dramatic, they needed a more dramatic vocalist. What about you, Donnie? What song stuck out to you?
Well, I like the track Charlotte the Harlot. Charlotte the Harlot was written by guitarist Dave Murray. It's supposedly about a prostitute named Charlotte. And, I don't know the Iron Maiden catalog very well, but apparently Charlotte is referenced a few more times in Maiden's history. There's a song called 22 Acacia Avenue.
I think that's from The Number of the Beast.
Okay. And then there's Hooks in You and From Here to Eternity. All of those, mention Charlotte. So, you know, just like Eddie, there's a character that
recurring character. Oh, yeah. We didn't mention Eddie on the album cover, the sort of zombie skeletal dude. I guess that started in their live shows. They just wanted a creepy monster, and it was one of the friend of the band or something made a paper mache mask, and Eddie, their mascot, who along with a recurring character, Charlotte the Harlot, been a part of Iron Maiden history.
So, Charlotte the Harlot is, you know, again, it has that propulsive, but also melodic bass line from Harris. You know, it's gritty. It's, you know, it's raw, very punk rock, I think. But, you know, I also hear, you know, or maybe early signs of, you know, some of the glam rock that, you know, that follows in this era.
You know, I read somewhere, heard somewhere that one of the guitarists was annoying the rest of the band because of his interest in George Benson as a guitarist. And they were trying to get away from sounding poppy or whatever. But Dennis, he was really into George Benson. I did hear that somewhere. I just thought it was an interesting
coincidence.
Potential coincidence. Wow. Here.
Very cool. But yeah, you know, I like this idea. I think the storytelling, you know, lyrics, you know, are something that, you know, carry on, you know, in the Iron Maiden tradition.
And uncomfortable subjects without fantasy. I think that was an important development as well. And that continued, you know, it's probably part of what was the draw of metal moving forward. The non-fantasy stuff was that it would talk about teenage depression or like shit that you weren't supposed to talk about, you know? And I think that probably drew young listeners at the time.
Right.
All right, so why don't we close it out with a interesting choice, right? So the band is Iron Maiden, the album is Iron Maiden, and they close out the song called Iron Maiden. So this serves sort of as a mission statement for the band, of one of those like this is who we are kind of things, but it also references the actual medieval torture device that the band named itself after.
Put them in the Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden?
Excellent.
Yeah. I don't remember what it is, like what the actual device was.
It's a cabinet with spikes inside that you would close on a victim.
Execute them.
Yeah, so scary stuff. And I think the music of Iron Maiden potentially could torture you, crush you, you know, you're trapped in this spiky box. I mean, I think it was a way for them to say we're dangerous, but it's got a slow crushing groove. The sneer in Deano's voice is even more evident here.
Yeah, it's so punk rock.
Yes. And it's less about storytelling and more about identity formation. Like, we're in your face. We're, you know, we are Iron Maiden, and we will torture your parents with music that they hate you listening to.
Yeah, the Beatles never did a song called The Beatles.
No, that would have been weird.
Yeah. But there are some. Right? Well, Sabbath has Black Sabbath.
Yeah. I am the Walrus would have been the place to do it. Okay. I am the Beatle.
I think maybe that medieval imagery sort of maybe takes them more in that kind of the direction they go
that
in.
They were going. Yeah.
Yeah, with the dark themes and the, I don't know, is it like the macabre? They're not really macabre. They're more like devil-y, right? Like the fantasy devil stuff.
Yeah, they're a mix of things.
Mysticism stuff, right?
Yeah, they start to play with all that fantasy stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's for another conversation. It starts here with just being in your face. So why don't we rewind and reflect on Iron Maiden as a whole? I'll kick it off with my clickbait headline. Iron Maiden slammed the door on the 70s with Nwabum riffs and punk attitude. 1980 never saw it coming.
Nwabum.
I know, it's such a weird thing.
We should do a spinoff where we're the Nwabum nerds.
There you go. That will crash quickly. This album is pure urgency, and it's like the band has something to prove, kind of, you know, playing fast, loud, and lean, street level metal forged in clubs with that punk aesthetic, and it's combustible and the future of metal. I think it's like the spark that lights it.
I'll give you my clickbait headline. From smoke-filled pubs to stadium dreams, Iron Maiden runs free before it can walk.
Iron Maiden?
Iron Maiden. Yeah, there's that song, Running Free. But I like this early version of Iron Maiden. I think I like the punk rockiness, which you can still hear in the future. But I think I might even prefer kind of this non-theatrical version. You know, it's... Sometimes that, you know, the Dickinson stuff can be a bit much, you know, for 45 minutes or so. I like the street level metal riffs.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, when I came to know Iron Maiden, it was after they were well established. So this, when I first heard it, was new to me to hear someone else doing the songs. As far as Killer to Filler goes,
they have an album called Killers.
That's true. Transylvania stuck out to me. An instrumental kind of had a, like I talked about Rush a little bit before, kind of felt like YYZ.
Oh yeah.
So that's where I think the progressive ish elements come into play, and the 70s hard rock vibes too, where it's not quite heavy metal as we later knew it in the 80s. But it's fast and ominous and cinematic and kind of hints at that epic scope that Maiden would later embrace. Strange World. What'd you think of that one?
Yeah, that one's kind of prog-ish, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that one.
I think it just shows their willingness to try shit out, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of more emotionally heavy and reveals like a side that's not really associated with early metal. Some track lists, the song Sanctuary is on the album. So the US version, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah. But so at the time, if we bought the record, we would have had Sanctuary.
Yeah, and I did listen to that. It doesn't hurt the album, but it doesn't really add anything.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, take it or leave it is pretty much what you'll get whenever whatever track list you end up listening to if you check out the album.
I like the song Remember Tomorrow. I like I like his voice on there. I like the soft, you know, vocal approach.
That's the one where he sounds very Geddy Lee-ish, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Well, just when he goes high.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, yeah. Yeah.
Instead of like going where, again, my mind thinks it should be going in Bruce Dickinson, and that's just not where they were at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. That's my own bias. Production wise, I guess they weren't really happy with the album, the production. I guess the producer was sort of not on board, just kind of, let's get this thing done. Mm-hmm. It's raw though, and built on momentum, not refinement. Did a pretty good job with the twin guitar attack. It's a little unbalanced here and there, which I think they worked on as time went on. They handled Paul's vocals, I think, well, production-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the rawness of the album. I think you notice a dramatic, you know, shift as you move into other albums. Similar to like the first Def Leppard record kind of sounds like this too before Mutt Lang, you know, took over.
Yeah, they were more in this new wave of British heavy metal camp. Mm-hmm. They were playing the same clubs as Iron Maiden, you know, so.
And what was the other? Saxon was around at the same time too, right?
Bruce Dickinson was the singer of Saxon. There were a lot of bands in that new wave of British heavy metal. Bands like Angel Witch, which were more, they went more in that fantasy direction. Diamond Head, which was did more of the speed metal things that became big influences on bands like Metallica and Megadeth. So that era of heavy metal really did establish what it became in the 80s anyway and into the 90s.
So the original wave is like Zeppelin, Sabbath, and Judas Priest, I guess, or Deep Purple.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So replay value, done?
Yes.
Listen to this again? Yeah?
Definitely. And I think if I'm in mixed company, because I think there are some people that kind of roll their eyes at the more like dramatic Iron Maiden stuff. And I think sort of more like classic rock people might appreciate this record a little more than Seventh Son of the Seventh Son.
True. Yeah, I mean, this isn't my favorite Maiden album, but it is fun to go back to and explore the early movements toward the metal I came to enjoy the most. Legacy-wise, we kind of have really covered all that. It didn't define 80s metal sound, but it opened the door for it. That's as far as I'll go because we've really talked a lot about its influence. Anything to add there, Donnie?
No, I just wanted to comment on how, you know, Maiden has sold so many records and so many posters, you know, without ever really having a hit, you know,
true.
Like never like a real MTV video.
No crossover power ballad thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
It's pretty amazing.
It really is. So raw, fast, and full of urgency, Iron Maiden's debut captures a band defining its sound in real time. Rough around the edges, but driven by pure energy. So check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
We've been spending some time in 1980. Did you get a chance to teleport back to home?
What?
I don't know. I'm mixing up my metaphors. I'm yeah, starting to think.
Teleporting.
I'm starting to quantum
travel.
Leap.
Okay. You know?
Yeah. Did you ever leap back home to find something to dig?
So I really didn't have a whole lot of time. I love the 80s so much that I just immersed myself in 80s music all week, not just the albums that we talked about. But there was an album in 2025 that we didn't mention on the show previously that got a lot of attention, and I enjoy it as well. It's Geese Getting Killed. Geese are a Brooklyn-based art rock, indie rock band whose restless genre-defying sound, you know, for the time, blends post-punk energy, experimental textures, and some lyrical wit. They've been kind of rising as one of Generation Z's most talked about rock acts, which there aren't a whole lot of those. I think that's what's drawn me to them. Let's listen to the title track from Getting Killed. Guess what it's called? I hear the Talking Heads and Radiohead and probably some other bands with head in the name. But yeah, this is our fourth studio LP. It's chaotic. And I think it's an imaginative take on rock. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I hadn't heard their previous records, and, you know, I spent some time with this, you know, as we were approaching the end of the year, and I don't know, I haven't been moved by it yet. I mean, it's fine. It reminds me, the approach kind of reminds me of, like, Modest Mouse. Mm. I don't know. I don't totally get what the fuss is about, but maybe it just hasn't hit me yet.
Old man alert.
Hey, old man river, zip it or break your head.
And then, of course, since I had been focused on 1980 so much, another album that I own a copy of, Prince, Dirty Mind from 1980. It was his third studio album. Of course, we know who Prince was. Singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, genius, blending funk and rock and pop and R&B. But on this album, it was produced and performed largely by him. It's got stripped-down funk, but it's got some new wave elements as well. Why don't we listen to a little bit of When You Were Mine? I really love this album, and it's one of those that's just odd that it exists. Like, he heard heard new wave music. It's like, I'm going to fuck around with that a little bit.
Yeah, and I like that. I like that sound.
Have you listened to this album, Don?
I haven't.
You really should.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds up my alley.
The album cover's a little... He's wearing like a bikini briefs and a handkerchief around his neck. And
Yes, I've seen that, yeah.
A leather jacket. But, you know, it's Prince being Prince. Mm. But you should definitely check that one out. Anybody that hasn't heard it, it's an interesting one while he was still figuring things out.
All right. Well, I found another album that came out in 2025, but it didn't make my year-end list because it technically isn't from 2025. So Donovan, you know, the Scottish folk pop singer, songwriter, you know, Mellow Yellow, Sunshine Superman. We actually did his record that was produced by Rick Rubin. Remember we did that show?
Sure do.
Yep. Well, he released an album called What's a Girl? But it actually is from like 1993, and it was never released. So actually listening to it, I mean, it's, I actually enjoy it a lot. Here's the title track, What's a Girl? What's a girl like you doing in a century? I like this idea of lost albums that suddenly, you know, surface.
Depending on why they were lost, do they suck?
I don't know what happened with this one. I don't think this album sucks at all. I think maybe it wouldn't have had a place in 1993. I'm not sure. I don't know if that was a time that people would have been, you know, revisiting Donovan. Yeah, definitely check it out if you like Donovan at all. And I've been reading a book, you know, which doesn't happen all that often. Yes.
The professor reads.
So Cameron Crowe released a book in 2025. Of course, Cameron Crowe is the music writer, also, you know, screenwriter and director, did Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Of course, the movie Almost Famous is, you know, loosely about him.
Singles.
Oh, yeah, Singles, too. But anyway, so the book is called The Uncool, a memoir, and it mainly focuses on his early years. I mean, so just like it, true to Almost Famous, you know, he was, you know, a teenager kind of going out and interviewing people like, you know, Zeppelin and the Eagles and David Bowie. It's a really interesting book, and it only gets up to, you know, the point where he's starting to direct films.
Yeah, I might have to check that out. I'll look on Audible. Cameron can read it to me.
Yeah, I wonder if he narrates it.
I'm sure he does.
There's also some family dynamics. I don't know if you remember from the movie, but his mother, played by, you know, Frances McDormand, you know, is a very interesting character and a very powerful force in his life. So definitely check it out. It's cool. Cameron Crowe, The Uncool, a memoir. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about the time in the show when I'm reminded of the words of Freddie Mercury. They also, wasn't The Game from 1980?
Oh.
Another One Bites the Dust.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty good Queen album. Anyway, back to Freddie Mercury. He said, "We are in a golden age of music. There will be a time when technology becomes so advanced that we'll rely on it to make music rather than raw talent, and music will lose its soul."
Mm.
Holy shit, Fred. Nailed it. That's why we love the 80s, and we're going to be playing around in those waters for 10 episodes.
Going to live in it as long as we can.
Yeah, exactly. With that in mind, let's bring out the Wheel of Musical Discovery to see what kind of albums from 1981 we'll be talking about next time.
Next time, We continue our I Love the 80s series with 1981. Big hits and crossover vibes lead the way as the episode dives into country and pop, spotlighting two albums that carried the 80s forward with style, shine, and chart-topping appeal.
Pop and country. Yeah, country music in the early 80s was at a crossroads, I feel like.
I feel like 9 to 5 might have been 1980, so I don't think we can do that.
Yeah, darn it. Get some Dolly on here.
Should be interesting. What's your favorite record from 1980 or 1981? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And you can visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 320 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you, as always, for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast, this time in 1980, but we'll see you next time in 1981.
So during this I Love the 80s series, I am going to sing television theme song from that year, but I'm going to throw in like an Album Nerdish lyric, and you're going to guess what show it was. You ready?
I'm ready.
I don't care what you say anymore. This is my album.
Bosom Buddies.
Yes. Very good.
Starring Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari.
Yes.
I'm sorry, people. I just know this stuff.
I'll try to stump you next week.
Good luck. See y'all next time. 1981. Woohoo!